Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Hey everybody, I'm Daniel McCarthy, and this is the Story of Nowhere podcast. I hope you found the month of March to your liking, are enjoying the newly minted season of spring, and managed to navigate April Fool's Day without being electrocuted. As for myself, things have been pretty hectic, and so I haven't put out an episode in almost a month. But here we are. I'm still here, you're still here, and we got another show. But maybe you're new. Maybe you're a brand new listener. And if you are a new listener, maybe you've decided to go back to the beginning of my episode catalog. And maybe you've come across my brief history of critical thinking series that I did way back at the beginning of the podcast. And maybe that's got you thinking all about logic and reason and that kind of thing. Or maybe you missed that series and now you're starting to think, well, that does sound kind of interesting and logic and reason and critical thinking do seem important, so maybe those are things I should look into. Or maybe you're an old listener and you've already listened to that series and you're thinking, you know, I haven't thought about that critical thinking stuff in a long time. Maybe I should revisit it. Well, if you fit into any of those categories, or maybe some other category that I haven't thought of, you're going to like today's show, because today's show is, I think, an entertaining, interesting, an invigorating conversation about logic. If you've been listening for a while, you probably know that I run a book club. But it's not your standard pick a bestseller and talk about it kind of book club. It's a great books club, in which we discuss the so-called great books of the Western world. Stuff like Homer and Plato and Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Shakespeare, Gibbon, etc. Well, yeah, so lately we've been reading Aristotle. Specifically, Aristotle's Organon, which is the collection of works in which he introduces formal logic. That thing is one hell of a brick, let me tell ya. We're currently working through Prior Analytics, which is the chunk where Aristotle introduces us to deductive logic and the syllogism. Let me read you a bit of this thing. This is probably the clearest bit that I've found so far. Listen to this. In particular syllogisms, if the universal premise is necessary, then the conclusion will be necessary. But if the particular, the conclusion will not be necessary, whether the universal premise is negative or affirmative. First, let the universal be necessary, and let A belong to all B necessarily, but let B simply belong to some C. It is necessary, then, that A belongs to some C necessarily, for C falls under B, and A was assumed to belong necessarily to all B. Got it? So that's what we're reading, and we're plugging along, God help us. But that's Prior Analytics. And before you come to that in the Organon, you go through something called On Interpretation, a nice little work on logic written by the big guy himself. Maybe. It might be his student's lecture notes. No one's really sure. But whatever, doesn't really matter. It at least reflects the thought of Aristotle, of that we can be pretty sure. So anyway, in today's show, what you're going to be hearing is the recording of my little book club's meeting on Interpretation. I found it to be a fairly exceptional discussion, and so I figured it would be well worth the work to pluck it out of the ether and provide it for all of you out there to enjoy and consider. At the very least, you might find it useful. Lord knows a little brush-up in basic logic is always in order. So I'll leave you to it, and get back to my bitter work on the next episode of the Story of Nowhere podcast. And until then, you know the drill. Share the show, subscribe to the show, and consider buying my book at storyofnowhere.com/book. Oh, and remember to check out roadtohellfilmreviews.com for my dystopian film review show with my friend Nikki P. I already gave you a little taste of episode 1 of that show, which was on Planet of the Apes, which was a great deal of fun, and I hope you all went and checked out the full version of that episode, once again at roadtohellfilmreviews.com. Well, now we've got a second episode out about the 2017 film The Circle, starring Tom Hanks and Emma Watson, and we've got episode 3 in the can, and we've also got video versions of the show available on YouTube and Odyssey. And of course, I'll put the links to all that stuff in the show notes. But make sure you're checking that out. It's a lot of fun. One more time, roadtohellfilmreviews.com. So there. Now, please do enjoy listening in on this conversation on Aristotle's On Interpretation. Right. Well, I suppose we can get right into it.
It's hard to know where to start because he's so, I don't know, I guess I want to say clinical, but that's not exactly the right word.
It's pretty close to the right word.
You know what I mean, right? which I really like. It fills me with this sense of reassurance almost reading Aristotle. But it's sort of like, it's hard to know what to say about it. And a lot of it's pretty self-explanatory. It's almost like just a grammar class, literally, at least so far. I mean, I know later on we'll get into more of like his metaphysics and ethics and things like that. And we have to get through this part first so that we understand his language.
Well, it is a lot of grammar, which, as we know from like Trivium talk over the years, is very important in laying the groundwork for logical thought. I think this came up last time. And it definitely applies to this work. It definitely applies to this work too. And that's the idea that this stuff that he's describing is so fundamental, it's almost confusing to see someone talking about it. Because these are processes that go on in the background. You know, it's like if someone were to, I don't know, maybe it's not quite the same, but if someone were to describe how you feel in a certain situation, it might almost take you aback because you never think about it, even though you get it and you know it very well. It's like everything he says in here.
It's language therapy.
Yeah, right. Everything you know, everything he says in here, you already know it, but you get, or for me anyway, sometimes I trip over the words because I'm like, wait, is he really saying that really, really simple thing that I think he's saying?
Well, and he's so specific that it almost seems like he's using too many words. But he's actually not. He just wants to be clear. It literally is a grammar class. And I don't mean grammar in the Trivium way. I mean grammar in the language arts way. And he starts with the parts of speech. What is a noun? And what is a verb? I have it right here. They're well, I have long. My paraphrase anyway of it. A noun is a sound significant by compact or convention without time. And they don't express any judgment. And then a verb is that which, in addition to its proper meaning, carries with it the notion of time. Health is a noun, but healthy is a verb. What do you guys think?
It's difficult because we're reading this in another language than it was originally done. Because, of course, you know, technically, in a sentence, like healthy isn't the verb. It's like if I've said like to be healthy, be is the verb. But in this, I get what he's saying in this case, because he's referring to like the quality of health occurring.
Actually, technically, to be healthy is the predicate of the sentence, which is known as the action.
Right.
So technically, even in modern grammar, healthy would in some senses be considered a part of the verb. It's so like later on, he has this, he's more specific, like in the sentence, Homer is a poet. Homer is the subject. Is a predicate and a poet is a predicate, but is a poet is the intended predicate.
Yeah. And the reason I think he's describing this is so it's clear that, and it's really important to go back to these basics because so oftentimes when you're having conversations or especially arguments with people, the language, it only takes a couple minutes for the language to start getting muddy. And so he's just almost drilling you like a coach. You know, you're, like this is running through the tires at football camp or something. He's just drilling you on the basics of moving your own mind. You know, wax on, wax off.
Yeah. And how often in an argument or a discussion do you come to a point where you or your the person you're discussing with goes, well, that's just semantics. That's just a semantical point. And then, so then how do you decide how important are the semantics in this conversation and how much can we disregard this little like semantic judgment that I'm making? And he makes a point to clarify all of those things in here. And he actually at one point even brings up that this is how we combat the casuistry of sophists, which I had to look up that word. I was like, casuistry. I'd never heard it before, but it's just the use of clever but unsound reasoning, and it's tied to the word sophistry. I almost think it must come from this book. And it to me, it revealed that Aristotle, as much as Plato, was interested in combating the effects on his culture of sophistry. And it's that is interesting to me, and like more of like a historiographical. How the fuck do you say that word?
Historiographical.
Thank you. In a historiographical way, because we only know of the sophists from people like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle, I mean. And you hear about them in our culture in this watered down kind of way. Like I heard of sophistry and sophists before I ever studied Plato. And so they just have this sort of legendary veneer over them. And it's not until you actually go back and read all of Plato and all of Aristotle that you realize that there were people in ancient Greek culture that saw them as a real problem, like an issue, like degrading the culture. And so I like to see that in here because I wasn't sure if Aristotle was going to bring that up or if he cared, or and it clarified to me more like how this really was an issue to a lot of people. What did you think of that, Danny?
Well, I have some spoiler knowledge, so Aristotle digs into the sophists kind of like Plato did. So,
well, that's not spoiler knowledge, but try and tell us a little bit about that without telling us too much about that.
I don't know enough about. I just know that Aristotle later on, I don't even know what work it's in, but we will get to it. Aristotle does a sort of catalog of the different minds of the time, and his work is really what is how we know about the so-called pre-Socratic people. And a lot of them would fall under the category of sophists. His work is what actually biographizes those folks. Cause we don't really have, I mean, you remember we read some of the pre-Socratic stuff before we started Plato.
Some of it was good.
Some of it was good, but most of it was like a sentence here, yeah, a paragraph there. It was very fragmented.
And silliness too. There was a lot of silliness.
Aristotle actually says like, oh, I knew this guy, or I knew someone who knew this guy, and here's a whole treatment of his thing. So he gets into the sophists.
Yeah. On the casuistry, I looked that word up too. And it comes from the Latin word casus, meaning like case. And I was thinking, and this is just speculation because I don't know all that much about the sophists, but it could be that they would just bring up these cases. Like Aristotle's illustrating these general rules, and I can see just an annoying sophist just saying, well, what about this? What about this? And what about that?
Right.
You know, that blows up all your rules. And he's like, okay, so we have to make these accommodations for the sophists because they're going to keep bringing all this annoying stuff to try to invalidate all the things that we're trying to build here.
Oh, that's I'm glad you looked that up. Can you pass me the pen?
I like that analysis because certainly we've all encountered the all too common trick of the sophist, or maybe they're unwitting, but you say something like, you know, generally men are taller than women or something. And invariably someone's going to be like, oh, but my cousin's a girl and she's, dude, we get it. You know, if you can't speak in generalities or hold generalities in your head, you can't talk. So anyway, yeah, that's, I like that. You might be onto it there. Also, when you first said case, I thought like a legal case.
Yeah, that's
which,
what I thought.
Which might be also kind of it might be a stretch, but you know, rhetoric started in Sicily and it was the art of the lawyers. Like lawyership and rhetoric started at the same time in Sicily. And that came over that's kind of where the sophists, some of the sophists came from. They came out of that Sicilian rhetoric tradition. So I just thought of like a legal case. That's another way of
potentially interpreting. Were sophists all the way into like Roman culture?
Well, you could argue that there are sophists all throughout history right up to now.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean.
I was going to add a couple things, and it might start off as a little bit of a tangent, but Jan Irving came out with a new video a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about schizophrenia. And he, in particular, you know, between him and his guest, they were essentially saying that Socrates was a representation of a schizophrenic. And I thought, that's very interesting. And then I had a conversation the next day. I watched that, and I had a conversation with Bob Podowski the next day. And I said, you know, I was telling him about that. And he goes, you know, that's what they say about the God of the Old Testament. He was a schizophrenic. And I was, damn it, here comes again. And so then I started looking into this a little bit more. And to cut the story short, I'm on a YouTube channel of a guy that's talking about schizophrenia. He's he's been a schizophrenic, or whatever you call him, for like 26 years. And he's also a professor for like 14 years. And he says, the solution to schizophrenia is philosophy. And he points out that, like David Hume, the idea that perception is reality is wrong. And schizophrenia is kind of a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and this kind of relates to what we're talking to today is really this kind of like you start at the absolute base and then you kind of build on that. And for like a schizophrenic, that's kind of like just, you know, lost between two worlds, being able to stop and kind of set down what are the foundations and then kind of build from there, they can like restore themselves to reality.
Yeah.
And a common experience with other people.
Yeah. That's really interesting lens to look at it through, because it's such an extreme example of how useful this stuff can be. I think it almost illustrates its utility better. Because, you know, as like we were saying earlier, as you're reading this, you're thinking to yourself, like your eyes start to glaze over, because it's almost like you're reading something that you already know so well, but seeing it put into so many words, it seems ridiculous. Right. But if you, you know, get up, walk around and sit back down and focus again, you start to see that how important it is to make sure that the way you're describing your experiences, your thoughts, and your reality makes sense. That it doesn't contradict itself, that you're using your language in the way that is most closely representative of what is actually happening. Because again, that's something that a lot of us struggle with, I think, is getting into conversations with people. And I mean, I don't know about you guys, but for me, it's really common where eventually somebody starts to bring up that language doesn't mean anything. It's just symbolic. And it's just our poor attempt at, you know, representing something that's much deeper. And in a way that's true. And he describes it, I think, as symbols of the passions of the soul. He says that syllables, sounds, voices, these are the words that he uses for language, are just the symbols of the passions of the soul. And he's right. But when you read Aristotle as compared to these blithering midwits, you realize that's a profound thing. That's not a meaningless thing. It can be very profound, especially if you use the tool in the most effective way. So I really like that tangent.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because Jan has since made another video with another guy and talked about, you know, how, you know, like modern society is really turning people into schizophrenia or into schizophreniacs. Mm. And, you know, I mean, like this idea of like being online and having like an online persona versus like your real life persona, and like how many people like dislike their real life persona, but, you know, feel like they can design their own avatar in the online world. And this kind of creates this like schizophrenic break between the two. And then I did an interview with a lady that's in Passios, one great network. And she was talking about Operation Mind Control, the book, and how that author, he says, like in the 1970s, there were only like 24 cases of split personality. And by the 90s, there were like 40,000 like reported cases and probably 2 or 3 million. And these are a result of like the CIA experiments on people, because they've been experimenting all in these different ways to like split people's personality through different means. So they're creating this huge schizophrenia kind of thing. And to a large degree, a lot of, you know, and this goes back to Albert Schweitzer's book, but he says that like, you know, by kind of instituting the work week, that, you know, like people have no time to really think. And so then like their inability to think kind of gives them that opportunity to just, you know, send them off into la la land, you know, and kind of program people's subconscious so that they have these two, you know, essential personalities that they identify with, you know, because they're, you know, that's the main goal of advertising, is this kind of for people to identify the products with themselves. And so by kind of creating that situation, you know, I don't know, man, there's a lot to go into there, but needless to say, you know, what Aristotle, I think, is really demonstrating is like establishing rapport with people, you know, through like going right to the basics and like saying, okay, this is what we're understanding here, right at the first building blocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's kind of putting his hand out and saying, look, we're actually in the same place here. Whereas you get a lot of this, it's a modern thing, but it's also very, very old. This idea of like, everything's an illusion, man. You know, like there is no reality. And it's like, well, if you get into that, you're kind of setting your, even if you're not like technically, physiologically schizophrenic, you're kind of choosing to adopt a semi-schizophrenic worldview in a way, where if there is no reality, if it's all an illusion, then you can never, ever, ever really know somebody as anything other than a figment of your own imagination. And he said, and so there's nothing to establish. There's really nothing to say. There's nothing. There's no meaning to be had. It's all just imaginary. Whereas
it's also a self-centered world.
Totally. Yeah. It's like solipsistic. Even if they don't realize it, it is. And he's saying, no, we have shared concepts, and we can agree on language to refer to those concepts. He's not even really like establishing language as anything more than it is. That's why he keeps referring to it as, it's just a sound, but it refers to something that's bigger and that's real. And, you know, when I was a little kid and I first heard of schizophrenia or the idea of like voices in your head or seeing things and stuff, as a little kid, I was like, oh, well, that wouldn't be so bad, so long as I knew it was just a voice in my head. Like if,
because well, that's what happens to you anyway.
Well, no, not to that extent. But like, if you always saw something, like if there was some beast that you always conjured up, maybe this isn't quite true, because I know obviously there's like chemical hormonal stuff that happens. But when I was a kid, I was like, if you just knew that every time you saw that dog monster, it was fake, then what's the big deal? But that implicit in that assumption is like, you need to have that baseline of reality. And I think that's kind of what he's doing here, is he's saying, we can all stand on the same ground, more or less. We can refer to the same things. And here's the best way we can do that is through language. And so I'm going to beat language to death, so we're all on the same page with it, so we can actually communicate for once instead of talking past each other.
Right.
Poor guy.
Well, yeah, it's rare that we really get to examine our assumptions. And that's I think, you know, Aristotle's very thorough in making sure that he's not leaving any assumption unexamined. And, you know, if you're having these kind of conversations without knowing kind of what's going on in the back room, like, how do we verify this? How do we know that this is what we're saying is verifiable? You're just sort of in the dark. So I think it's nice that he's doing this groundwork so that we can kind of go forward and talk about more complicated things because we've done at least this work of establishing the clarity that this comes from. I think that's kind of the big idea for me behind grammar is how much more clarity of mind you get when you're reading and even thinking about things. When you know grammatically, you know, this is true and verifiable and this corresponds to this very clearly. I mean, you get just so much clarity of thought. And then you also, that results in clarity of communication when you're communicating with others and they're communicating with you. Your communication is that much clearer. So I think that's sort of the goal of this exercise is for that clarity.
Yes. And I, oh my God, there's so many things I want to say about that. First of all, this should be a requirement for anybody who is going into journalism. They should have to read this book because I don't know about you guys, but there is so much garbage writing out there right now. It almost makes you wonder how these people even graduated from college, let alone got a job as a journalist. I'm not going to harp on that too much because we all know. But the other thing that you said that triggers something for me was that Aristotle doesn't take anything for granted. And it's clear that that's the case because he does that thing where he'll make a proposition, a thesis statement, and say, if we follow this line of reasoning, like this is something that Plato did all the time too. If we follow this line of reasoning, then this must be true. But let's look at it more closely and see if it really is true. And eventually he'll disprove it. Now, when you're taking notes, this is super annoying because he'll declare the first proposition as though it's true. And so you write it down and then he goes and disproves it. And you have to scratch out like three lines of notes in your notebook. But anyway,
can I comment on that?
Sure, dear.
Isn't it funny that school taught you and trained you to take notes in a way that is precisely not amenable to a complicated lecture like this.
Yeah, and I was a good student too, so it's like ingrained into me.
It's like when you're taking notes, you're conditioned to just assume almost that the person at the front of the room is telling you exactly the thing you need to know rather than walking you down a path. Like Aristotle isn't saying flashcard, fact, 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 here's what you need to know. He's taking you by the hand and walking you down a little garden path, mm-hmm. You know? And that's literally what his school was too. It was like a little garden and they would walk. They called it the walking school. And these dudes would just walk in circles all day talking about this
stuff.
Ooh,
that sounds like fun.
But it's like, if you're walking around, who's taking the notes? You know, it's pure. Anyway.
That's why I don't think they were lecture notes because he didn't have those big lectures like we imagine now. But so the one that he ended up deciding wasn't true after all, I want to bring it up. He says, the contradictory of it may be is it may not be, not it cannot be. But then, so I wrote that down. And then he goes and he's like, well, but wait a second. If something may be, it also may not be, right? So then this doesn't make sense. So we have to go back and make more sense of it. And I'm glad that he did that because it did make me think it through more carefully. But I scratched it out really thoroughly in my notes because I have that thing where once I write something down as being true, it's really hard for me to forget it if it's not true. So I took my pen and just like scratched it out as aggressively as I could. But he's right. And you don't think about little things like that usually when you're talking, you know? So it's kind of, like I said, like therapy, where you're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is like therapy. I mean, he's whatever knots may lay at the base of your mind, he's taking the trouble to untangle. It doesn't have to do with, you know, your mom, your dad, or you wet the bed when you were a kid or any of this kind of stuff. It's like, no, if you just if you just have a clean mind and tidy mind, the assumption kind of is you'll figure that stuff out on your own. Like, if you're thinking about truth in a tidy, orderly fashion, as he's presenting us with, I don't know, it seems like it could solve a lot of problems. Maybe not all your problems, but it seems like it could help at least with a lot of them. To just be able to face things as they are and articulate them as they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Make sense of them.
Yeah.
This is enabling you to do that on your own rather than relying on somebody else to do it for you.
Exactly. Right. Language is the key to understanding concepts in reality that does not require a mediator. I mean, I guess language is itself the mediator, but you are the one who deals with it directly. There's no priest mediating for you.
Speaking of language being a mediator, what translation is everybody working with?
Edgehill. E.M. Edgehill.
E.M. Edgehill. Okay. I haven't heard of that guy. You've got Richard McKee on. He's the classical.
Oh, here it is. It says edited and with an introduction by Richard McKee, and it doesn't say he translated it.
Oh.
We can't find the translator of this. What the heck? This is my favorite one so far, but I don't know who the fuck did it.
Well, the translator of mine is bad. He does a bad job. His name is Octavius Fuera Owen, some lunatic German.
No, he's not a German.
Oh.
That's the audiobook version I've been listening to, is the Octavius Owen.
Really?
Oh,
yeah. It's certainly something.
It's rough.
Yeah. But I almost appreciate it as an audiobook because it sort of washes over you and you can kind of catch things as they're passing by. I don't know. It's odd to say it that way, but uh-huh. You probably know what I mean.
It does make sense.
So you said you were using archive.org and LibriVox. Are they both using that translation?
So the LibriVox is a gentleman reading from that translation. The archive.org version is actually by Thomas Aquinas, which was frustrating to use because there are actually more notes of his commentary on it than there are of the actual text. So I eventually switched to something else because it was impossible.
Our scholastic friends really know how to mark up a book.
Yeah, they do.
So maybe Richard McKeon translated this one. This one is really clear.
It should say.
I like it.
Contents, usually.
In the contents?
I've got the written version. I've got, of course, I'm doing all my stuff online, but it was E.M. Edgehill is the text. But I was, like you were saying earlier, I could not keep my eyes open reading this. So then I went to the audiobook myself. And I'm not exactly sure what version that was, but it was certainly different.
Do you like it better?
Well, I was able to, you know, do other things and listen to it and stay awake.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it, you know, it is, it's like you were saying before, you know, it's kind of like being like a, you know, a full on calculus student and then going back and like having to go through like a semester of like arithmetic, you know, you're going, oh God, please.
Yeah.
It'll be over.
Yeah.
It's jarring. It's jarring, especially because you expect this, like you, after reading Plato, as much, we spent a year on Plato, it's like you expect to crack open Aristotle and him to be talking about like God and all of this like wild.
You expect him to pick up where Plato left off.
Right. But instead he goes even more basic than Plato ever really got. I mean, also though, Aristotle is a fantastic thing to read after Plato because he is just kind of picking apart this idea of there being forms and universal concepts. He's just really drilling into it. And almost making, you know, when you read people who summarize the philosophers, at least for me, I kind of get this impression that it's like Plato versus Aristotle, you know, but really I just see this as a sort of compliment to Plato. Almost.
It's an extension of like Parmenides almost.
Yeah.
Like Parmenides was really complex and metaphysical and hard to understand. And this is almost like Aristotle's way of creating rules for us so that we could do what Parmenides was doing in a way that's easier to understand. If that makes sense. Like I wonder if Plato had these rules and this like clear structure of language when he wrote Parmenides, if maybe it would have been easier to understand. That's one thing I'm thinking. But then I'm also thinking, like, when you actually read like his little examples and stuff, like man is or man is not, when he goes on about things like that, it just sounds like something that's coming straight out of Parmenides too. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. It's a drilling down. Maybe not drilling. It's just stretching out of a lot of the things that Plato just sort of glossed over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good. It's definitely clear that Aristotle knew Plato and that they were kind of, even if they maybe disagreed on certain things.
Well, wasn't he Plato's student?
He was Plato's student, yeah. But even if they disagreed, you can definitely tell that they're not really in opposition. They're both looking for the same thing. They're both, I think, at least in these books, I think they're genuinely pursuing truth, whatever that is. And it's a muddy battle sometimes, but I think that's what they're doing here. And I appreciate it very much.
Well, I would just say, you know, I do feel like each of these, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, or at least what we've seen so far, are following a similar pattern where they are kind of establishing rapport and kind of establishing what their line of logic is and how they're looking at things. And then it starts to take off into a little bit more imaginative kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I do feel like, you know, we're on a similar path. And there are people that say that, you know, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle are kind of like Solomon, Moses, and Jesus, right? and so you get these kind of different flavors of the same thing.
Yeah, that is true, or it rings true anyway, that they each have their own unique way of approaching the battle. I don't know why I keep calling it a battle. The problem of truth, they approach it differently, but ultimately they are doing the same thing. And I think that we're kind of doing the same thing here in parsing it out, like trying to figure out what the hell's going on in this world of ours and how we can talk about it in a clear, concise, responsible, accurate way.
Right.
And so speaking of truth, one of the things that really stood out to me in this book, and I'm really happy he got into it, was the types of falsehoods, or, you know, like the differentiation between a contradiction and opposition. I thought that was something that I definitely wanted to bring to the meeting that we could discuss. What did you guys?
What chapter was that in?
I don't know. I'll dig it up. But what did you guys, if you remember that, what did you think of that?
Well, I kind of had an insight on this because I had gone to Damien's presentation on logic, and he goes through this in excruciating detail.
The difference between a contradictory proposition and a contrary proposition?
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like he starts in 11 and he talks about that for...
No, chapter 7.
Oh, geez. Yeah, he talks about it for like half of the book.
Yeah, it's throughout the whole thing, kind of.
I think the first time it comes up is chapter 7.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I've got it here.
Contradictory propositions. Subject remains the same, but the affirmation is universal and denial is not. A contrary proposition is when both are universal.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck does that mean? I mean, I know what it means, but why? When is that going to be relevant? And why do we have to have a name for it?
Well, we have to be able to identify that sometimes something may appear to contradict something, but it actually doesn't necessarily contradict it. So a contradiction is if A is true, then B absolutely 100% cannot be true. You know,
by necessity,
if A, then B cannot be. Whereas in my translation, it's called opposition. You're saying the contrary is if A exists, well, maybe B does. We don't really know.
That's not how that.
I, you know, reading that chapter 7, it to me, it occurred that this could be a banned book in a few years. I mean, as many times as he says white, a white man. Every time I hear that now, I'm like, oh God.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too, because I didn't know, like, I mean, you know, white people are pink. So what is he talking about? You know what I mean?
I think he just wanted to use something that at the time was obvious and kind of self-evident, you know, to make his assertions, or, you know, I think just culturally it wasn't an issue, but yeah, it did occur to me that people would be like, oh my gosh, why does he keep bringing up race so much?
Right.
But is that even what he's doing?
I don't know.
I don't think
I doubt it. Yeah.
I think he's just saying, you know, like, the sky is blue. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, something obvious.
And also that there's the, most of these translations
are
from, like,
no people that are white.
Most of these translations are from, like, the 1800s.
Oh, so maybe they did that.
It could be
so. That's probably true too.
It's probably obvious that, you know what I mean?
We, like, don't know.
Hey, Bryn, could you look that up?
Word project.
I'll double check, but I'm pretty sure that the word is leukos, which is white. That's where we get the word leukemia for white blood cells. It's the disease of white blood cells. So, but I'll double check.
Well, I can take your word for it. That sounds correct. So he was saying, okay, well, I'll just shut up about that anyways. So the contradictions and the contraries was obviously a really important part of this book, but it was actually kind of one of the parts of the book that was hard for me to understand, because partly I think because he brings it up sort of all over. Like in chapter 13, when he's talking about contradictories and like relationships between propositions, and he goes into that long, he makes a chart of, I think that's in 13. I don't know. I couldn't quite wrap my head around all of that.
Now, well, is that another thing that was at one point a visual thing, and now we don't have the visuals, so it's harder to understand?
Maybe.
Could be, yeah.
Because it seems like it should be like in an Excel spreadsheet or something.
Right.
Yeah, you definitely need a visual aid with this to really kind of understand it. And that's the thing with Damien's presentation. He makes like a box, and then he has like these cross hatch things, which are the contradiction, they're lines of contradiction.
Yeah.
And it does make a lot more sense. You know, I think I was watching a video about this, you know, because following up on what Damien was talking about, and this, you know, this kind of logic idea was that, you know, like that either or kind of thing, like it's A or it's B, but it's if it's A, then it's not B. And then the, like that thing about is that even relevant, you know? So like, does that make a determinant? If you make a representation for each of those, so is it not relevant or is it relevant? And then that completes the four corners of the box, and then you can go from there. You know, I don't want to get into all that other stuff, but the contradictions are the ones that are like cross on the opposite sides of the thing. So like if it's this and it's relevant, then the opposite side is the potential for contradiction.
Yeah, the field of formal logic as we now have it has taken all of this stuff, which is presented in a linear fashion, and come up with all kinds of symbols and things that really that do help.
When I took logic in college, we were simply given propositions and then the tools to either prove or disprove that prove them, and it was almost like doing algebra. Like there were all these symbols and stuff, and I enjoyed it. They were fun puzzles, but I guess we didn't really get into like what is logic and like what does this stuff really mean? Maybe because, I mean, I think the problem I have with this text is that it feels like it's not something I can consciously understand. It feels like an instinct, and it feels like trying to consciously describe an instinct. And I'm struggling to make that connection between like back here and up here.
Right.
You know,
that's
I was just going to say, like, if we're having a debate about whether vaccines are good or bad, if there's a person that says, I don't care because I'm not taking them, then yeah. They don't even need to talk about the argument because they're just, it's irrelevant to them because they're just not going to participate, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that might be a different way to think about it. And, you know, so like be able to relate how, like things that are relevant and things that are not relevant, and then how those can be opposite, but yet still unnecessary.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. The logical discussion itself is predicated on the idea that you're both embodying or rather sharing a space in which the exchange of ideas is actually going to manifest something. And if you decide that you're not doing it, then, you know, for better or for worse, like sometimes you decide you're like, I'm not gonna, you know, it's like in that movie. Do you remember Dante's Peak?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Where the old lady doesn't want to leave her. It's like, all right, like, I disagree. Maybe I think you should go, but, you know, whatever.
Is that the one about the volcano?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Okay.
It's all a great movie.
I just pops in the boiling water and pushes the boat. Great flip.
It's awesome. Like that lady is my hero.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a great movie.
Sarah Connor's in it.
Oh, is that her?
What a great movie.
Oh, we
movie.
Have to rewatch that.
James Bond.
Yeah, right. James Bond.
There you go. Remington Steele.
Oh, Remington Steele.
that version of James Bond. But you know what? This does really does kind of describe like how you can respect another person's point of view on something, mm-hmm. and then be able to like listen. Because you could be arguing a point about a difference between one thing and another. But then, you know, like say you see the person just kind of droning off, and then you know, okay, well, this is maybe not relevant to them. So maybe I need to ask that question, you know? And so that is really kind of a way of like humbling a person from like, you know, just talking incessantly. Because if you see the person is not, you know, receiving the information, and if you're kind of in that mindset where you're going, are they understanding? Are they understanding?
Yeah.
It could be that. I guess if you take this book to heart, when you're in a conversation or an argument with someone, you have to listen carefully because you have to determine, first of all, are we even actually disagreeing? Are the things that we're saying mutually exclusive? Are they truly contradictory to each other, or can they coexist?
Yes.
And then once you have determined that you're making contradictory opinions, then you can decide who's right and who's wrong.
Part of the utility of Aristotle taking the trouble to articulate all this wild basic stuff is that, like you said, sometimes it does seem like it's instinctual. Maybe we all have this instinct, but if you don't articulate it, if we're in a conversation and I have that instinct, like I know something's wrong about what you're saying, but if I don't know why precisely it's wrong, then I don't really know if maybe I'm just having an emotional reaction or then how can I really explain to you why you're wrong if I don't know why you're wrong? I'm just like getting angry with you because it's bothering me, but I don't know why. With this, we now have the tool to say, well, actually, respectfully, here's why what you're saying is it doesn't follow. And once we get that out of the way and we get all the logical stuff out of the way that we agree on, now we can have a conversation. It's almost like he's providing a gateway for you to talk about your feelings and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like once you get the logical stuff done with, now we're available to share our subjective experiences, you know, once we're standing on logical ground. So it's difficult, but it's almost, I think, probably a requirement if you're going to have truly meaningful and transformative conversation to do your very best to dredge up this instinctive stuff and pull as much of it into your neocortex as you possibly can, memorize it, understand it, and appreciate it, because then you'll actually, you're not just reacting. You actually know why you're thinking the way you are, and you can articulate it, and that makes you a more powerful speaker and thinker, and therefore human being insofar as human beings are thinking, speaking creatures.
Yeah, that was actually why Michael's comment about it maybe becoming a banned book in the future. I thought you were going in a different direction with that, because it seems that people are so interested in getting, for one thing, their opinions out there, because the way that we're training students now is that you must give an opinion regardless of whether you have any logic to back it up at all. And then additionally, if that opinion is based on emotion, then it's supposed to be more meritorious somehow, which I think is really remarkable, considering that I think they still teach some of this logical stuff in schools, but yet, like, everything that a student's coming up to college with before they're reading this text is telling them almost the exact opposite as far as how to argue.
I don't think that it's common to study Aristotle even in college. I was a philosophy major and I didn't even hear his name.
Okay. See, that was my question, because you said, I was going to suggest that, but then I'm like, well, I mean, I don't have, you know, the same experience as all students. So, and when you said you studied in college, I was like, oh, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's a common thing.
No, I took Intro to Logic and they didn't even mention Aristotle's name.
Wow. So you wonder if the system that they have that turns logic into almost like mathematical symbols is maybe doing more to obscure the actual learning of the logical structure.
I think it is, because I was really good at that, but it was like playing a game. Mm-hmm. Like when we sat down and take our tests, it was like all we had to do was Sudoku or something, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get any understanding of like the metaphysics of logic. Like, what was the point of logic? Why do we do this? What is it? All I got was, here's some fun symbols and, you know, here's how you determine if these symbols indicate a contradiction or not, et cetera, et cetera.
Here's a toy to play with that when you get into an argument, you can pull out and say, well, I studied logic, so I'm right.
Right, right. Again, yeah. that thing where you have the very credentialed expert, yeah. You know, who has no clue.
Don't right. even bother arguing with me. I'm
well, that poor guy was an adjunct. He had no... But they don't teach this shit anywhere. The closest I ever got to learning this stuff was freshman year English class in high school, when they taught us how to take apart a sentence mm-hmm. and learn all the different parts of a sentence, which was another almost game-like activity that I enjoyed just for the diverting nature of it. This is not like that even. Although there are parts, I mean, I really enjoyed taking notes on Aristotle because I'm really like A-type minded. So I really like when certain words belong specifically to certain meanings, and then I can write them down and do my little colon and my underline and write the definition, you know. But it doesn't always actually help me understand what the fuck I'm reading.
I do want to push back on the idea that this isn't taught anywhere. The school that I was going to is it's a great book school, and they we do read a lot of Plato and Aristotle. Now we didn't do this book, so I'm glad to get the opportunity to do this now, because it's real important. I think for my school, there wasn't much of a emphasis on grammar, because I think they're saying like you should know the grammar by now or whatever, or at least we studied Greek and we learned the Greek grammar and supposed to pick up some of it that way. But there's many Catholic schools that still teach this as part of their curriculum. They still have a big liberal arts curriculum, even for their not college or high school, but even for young children, they kind of get them started, maybe not specifically on this book or anything like that, but they do get their children learning like Latin grammar. And so it's not completely extinct. It's still out there, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, but so it's rare, but it's not completely extinct.
Yeah. I wanted to comment on that too. You'll find it, like you said, there's great books programs, which obviously will touch on this. And, you know, the Catholics, you know, they are, at least in some circles, when you find the more traditional types, they are holding this stuff down. I took a logic course online by a Catholic dude, and he did all the symbolism and like, here's the formal logic stuff. But as he did it, he was like, well, this comes from Aristotle and here's why this matters. And here's blah, 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 blah. The Catholics, because they have that scholastic tradition, they do actually take this stuff seriously. You got to give them props for that, if nothing else. It's really when you get into like the hoity-toity cosmopolitan types of schools where people have decided that they're beyond this stuff. Mm. You know, at least in my experience, yeah. That's what it seems to be.
Well, I'll just testify to this because I went to Indiana University, then I went to Purdue University, and between the summers I stayed at Indiana and Purdue University in Indianapolis. But I used to always ask people because I was a president of a student organization for the National Association of Home Builders, and we predominantly had guys from the construction technology department. It was like all guys, like out of 500, it's probably 490 were guys. But then we had a contingent from the liberal arts department, which was interior design students, which were like 90% all women. But they were all liberal arts people. And I would ask them questions about liberal arts, like what are the liberal arts? And nobody knew what the liberal arts were, So, that alone was terrible. But I had read the great books when I was in the military. And so, like those people that are studying literature, what are they, reading, And they're certainly not going all the way back to Plato and Aristotle. They're focusing on like the Enlightenment, and mm-hmm. maybe a little bit prior to that. But most of the literature that they're studying is the modern literature.
Right. And even then it's like, are you reading the whole thing or are you reading excerpts that your teacher or the curriculum collected for you? Like, oh, we've already read all this and decided that this is all you need to know. Here's a paragraph of Plato. Here's book two of the Republic. We spent a year on Plato, man. And you know what? You could do it again and get more out of it. It's an infinite.
Okay, but not anytime soon.
Yeah, we'll wait. We'll wait a few years before we do Plato.
But I just say that because Indiana is like is really like a liberal arts kind of, left-leaning college. And Purdue is like an engineering, like conservative. And both of them, are kind of teaching the same thing in that regard,
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of a liberal arts desert out there. When you talk about the seven classical liberal arts, it really is very scarce. It's like we're the ones really keeping it alive, because even the school that I was going to. The seven liberal arts are basically they're the hidden curriculum. They're not the real, this is what's on the curriculum. The curriculum doesn't mention the seven liberal arts at all. If you dig deep enough, there is a mention of the seven liberal. Well, I don't even think they call it the trivium or the quadrivium or the seven liberal arts. They do mention the seven by name. You just have to keep digging for it. So it's dependent upon people like us to, actually study them directly.
Right. Well, the liberal arts really, are the definition of the knowledge of a free man, an independent sovereign man. This is the knowledge that we need to be that. And, it's obviously they want slaves because they're not teaching us how to be free sovereign individuals.
Yeah. And we already see in reading this stuff, certainly we saw it with Plato, but we can carry the lessons of Plato into Aristotle. The liberal arts tradition, it's linear in a way, like you kind of have to start with grammar and move your way up. But it's also an integrated curriculum almost where, as we've been saying, a really good way to actually get a grip on a lot of this logic stuff would be to move forward in the liberal arts and use geometry to come up with like spatial symbols to represent this logic. And that almost makes it resonate with the mind more. And so these formal logic courses, they do use geometrical patterns, and that somehow makes the linear process of logic sink in more deeply. So if we look across the spectrum of the liberal arts and almost do like a fractalization, like while we're studying logic specifically, within logic is a tiny little fractal of all the liberal arts. They're contained in each one. And if we go into it with that, like there's a logic to the stars. One of the liberal arts is astronomy. There's all of the liberal arts are present in that, just like they're all present in logic or grammar or whatever. So I'm actually kind of thinking it would be cool if once we get through the Organon, if we did like as a group, a little like a short formal logic course or something, and to do all the, to bring in the geometrical stuff and get the forms and stuff.
Could we get like a workbook with all the puzzles in it? That would be fun.
Yeah, we'll see about that. That might be, if everyone's interested.
I was just thinking that would be fun just to have like some puzzles.
Yeah.
To do.
We'll think about that. That might be something to do. But anyway.
When I was a little, this is a complete tangent and an anecdote. It means nothing, but I'm going to share it anyways. When I was a kid, they put me in Gifted and Talented because I wouldn't stop reading during my lessons and teachers didn't know what to do with me. And one of the things we did in GT were these fun puzzles that are like supposed to help you solve a mystery. And you have a bunch of different people and then characteristics or actions of those people. And it's in this, I don't know if you guys have ever seen it. It's in this big grid. And then you have all these different squares and then like a series of clues in word form, like almost like a word problem in math. And then you use all those clues to eliminate contradictions on the grid. And then you get to the answer of like who was doing what and where. And if I could find some more of those, that would be so much fun.
Yeah, that would be fun.
That was a good game. Did you ever get to do those?
I don't think
you
so.
You would love, I'm going to see if I can. I left my phone somewhere.
That kind of sounds like that game Guess Who, where you ask the other person, like, you know, do they have glasses or, you know, do they have blue eyes? And if they say yes or no, you just knock down the ones that, eventually.
That was a fun game too. I always loved things like that. And what was another good one?
Well, I don't know if it has a name, but I could find it and post it. I used to love it. And the beautiful thing about a logic puzzle is it doesn't even matter if you already know the answer, because getting there is the entire point.
Right.
They call it like Einstein's IQ test or something, but basically it just gives you all this information about, you know, there's a Norwegian, there's a Swede, there's a Dane. This guy lives in a yellow house, a blue house, blah, 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 blah. Gives you all these details about these people. It says, who has the fish? And you just have to, through process of elimination, figure out, you know, based on a set of rules, like every person only has one pet. You eventually have to whittle it down. You wind up who has the fish. I used to just love doing that thing when I was a kid over and over and over again, even though I knew the answer. So it's in that same vein of these games that you're talking about, because what you kind of have to do is draw a little diagram and X out this guy and da, 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 da. It's a lot of fun. I'll put that in the Aristotle chat in Discord.
Ooh, they're called logic grid puzzles. I'll put that in there too. I'll find some good examples. So there were more things about contradictories that were probably important to go over. So you guys were saying that contradictories are the propositions that by necessity preclude one or the other from existing or from being true. And then contraries were the ones where there's an allowance for the possibility of both being true. Is that the case? What, I still don't understand the difference between a contrary and a contradiction. And the reason why that's important is because in chapter 14, he clarifies that a true contrary concerns that which is of the essence of the subject. So like he gives an example. I don't remember exactly how it went, but it was something along the lines of you have a statement of like, it is possible that it should be, or it is not possible that it should be. And the reason why the true contrary is it is not possible that it should be, as opposed to it is possible that it should not be, is because the action and the true predicate of the subject is possibility rather than should be. But that's not really valuable to me if I don't know what the fuck a contrary is as compared to a contradictory. So can anybody help me understand that? I don't get it. Maybe I need to go back in the book. Maybe my notes aren't good enough.
Well, I'm going to give it a shot.
Okay.
But this is based on the stuff that I have in my head about Damien's stuff that I saw about a year and a half ago. So it's a little bit foggy to me, but the idea of something being is or isn't. So like if you put is on like the first corner of the box, and then on the second corner of the box is isn't. And then on the bottom corners of the box, you've got, it isn't relevant to the, to this thing, and it is relevant to the thing. Then the relevancy and the is a contradiction. Does that sound correct? And then the other side of that is that if it is not and it doesn't matter, is a contradiction. And you know, like you got to get deep on this one. but the thing is like you can't, you know, it's like that you can't know what you can't know, or you don't know what you don't know kind of thing. That's a contradiction.
So I think you don't know what you don't know would be the contrary, and the contradiction would be is or is not. I think. Let me see. I'm going to go back to chapter 7 and see. Yeah, so contraries are universal and contradictions are more specific. If then a man states a positive and a negative proposition of universal character with regard to universal, these two propositions are contrary. When, on the other hand, the positive and negative propositions, though they have regard to a universal, are yet not of universal character, they will not be. Okay, so that's about contraries. Sorry, what were you going to say? I didn't mean to talk over you.
Example that, if I understand this correctly, I thought it was all men are white being a proposition. The contrary to all men are white is no men are white. So that's contrary. And then the contradictory to all men are white is some men are not white.
That sounds right.
Yeah, so there's a statement about the universal, and then there's a statement about either an individual or a set within that universal. So it maybe a good way of thinking about it would be to refer back to categories, which we read last time, where he talks about genus and species.
I found it.
The species, your description of the species cannot go against any larger description that was made about the genus, because the species exists within it. And so when you describe something about the species that goes against the description of the genus, that's a contradiction.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. I'm glad that we're sussing this out because it was nagging at me. So I think I found the paragraph where he states it clearly. An affirmation is opposed to a denial in the sense which I denote by the term contradictory, when, while the subject remains the same, the affirmation is of a universal character and the denial is not. So this is what you were saying. The affirmation, every man is white, is the contradictory of the denial, not every man is white. Or again, the proposition, no man is white, is the contradictory of the proposition, some men are white. But propositions are opposed as contraries when both the affirmation and the denial are universal, as in the sentences, every man is white, no man is white, every man is just, and no man is just.
A contrary is simply, you're making a universal claim, and so either one of them can be so. Whereas a contradiction is you make a single universal claim, and then you deny a subset of that universal group. Maybe that doesn't clarify anything. All statements are clear. This statement was not clear. That is a contradiction, because I'm talking about my specific statement.
Okay. A specific denial against a universal is a contradiction.
Uh-huh.
And two universals which deny each other are contrary.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. I think I got it.
We really workshopped that one, huh? Hopefully we got it right. But I think so.
I'm writing it down in my notebook, so it better be right, because this is what I'm going to remember for the next 6 months before I forget it.
Yeah.
Just a little tidbit. The word for universal that he's using here is Catholu, which is where the word Catholic comes from. Just thought that's one of those things that it's nice to know that Catholic means universal. It means for I think the idea behind the Catholic Church is that they're supposed to be the one church for every individual in the entire world.
Yeah.
So, you know, the one universal church, the Catholic Church.
How do you spell that transliteration? Or as close as you have off the top of your head is fine.
I got it right here. So it's K-A theta. That's the T-H, the aspirated T. O-L, and well, I guess the case here is O-U. That's, I think, a genitive. Yeah, I don't know my Greek grammar that well, but...
Theta.
Yeah, theta. It's like an O with a line in the middle.
Okay.
So okay. K-A theta, O-L, and then O-U is the ending, the genitive ending, but, you know, you have your different endings. Okay. Depending on the case.
So Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Confused with Cthulhu.
Oh, and I do want to say that's actually like a contraction between kata and holu. So, I mean, that the word holy and holistic comes from this, and I think even whole itself, even though whole, we added the W on there. And then kata means from, or I guess down is like one of the words, but. When you combine kata and holu, that T and H from holu combine to make that theta. So yeah, it's a compound word.
Okay, so maybe we could, as an example of contrary versus contradiction, we could use the Catholic Church. So if the Catholic Church asserts itself as being the universal church, which its name does, it's the universal church. This is the church for everybody. If there's a pocket of people that say, we're not Catholic, they're existing in contradiction to that universal claim, right? So if you've got, let's say, a group of Muslims, they're not Catholic. They're in contradiction to the church as a group.
It's like an exception.
But in England or in the Reformation, rather than you had another group of people, say King Henry VIII, say, not only am I not Catholic, I oppose its universality. I am another universal church. That's a contrary.
Okay, now I think I get it. Thank you.
Nice.
I was raised Catholic, and so I like to...
Don't leave out the Orthodox. The Orthodox Church was the first schism of the Catholic Church.
Yes, that's actually a better example, for sure. They really broke off.
It's interesting, because I just was talking to a Cherokee, Yonah, the other day, and he was saying that, that's what the Cherokee represents. They will accept anybody, but they're considered the principled people is their kind of moniker is, you know, we have principles. We have these principles, and that's open to anybody. And the same thing with Shambhala, Bobby Boyce, the kingdom of Shambhala is the enlightened people. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like they are open to anybody. They'll take anybody's wisdom as long as they meet, you know, as long as they just kind of observe a criteria.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, and another example of that in theory back in the old days, probably now too, but like the Freemasons, they were another sort of institution which said, so long as you accept that there is a supreme being, we'll let you in. And they had this sort of universality, like we're all one brotherhood, blah, 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 blah. Of course, it didn't always work that way in practice, but the theory was kind of, they were an alternative universal force to the Catholic Church. And so there were battles between them, and the Catholic Church and Freemasonry existed in a state of contrariness, I suppose, not contradiction, because they were both making opposite or opposing universal claims about the domain or the nature of the divine. So maybe a contradiction, I guess, would be maybe not like an alternative religion. A contradiction to the universal Catholic religion would maybe be a group of heretics. So like the Albigensians or something exist in contradiction. But anyway, we can talk theology all day.
You can talk theology all day. I have shit to do.
Yeah. I think that was probably the biggest part of this book for me anyway, was the distinction between contradiction and contrary. Because it's a nuanced thing. It's not necessarily something you would think about there being different types of negation.
So why does it matter? Why does it matter if you clarify different kinds of denials of a proposition?
Because a contrary, that's a universal claim, but a contradiction would be just because it's dealing in universals and particulars, you can say that all men are just as a categorical statement.
But Danny is not just.
Right. So, but what that means, it doesn't mean that no one else is just. So it's not making like a universal statement one way or the other.
It doesn't mean that no man is just.
Exactly.
But it does mean that not all men are just.
So the universal claim is wrong, but it's not negated. It's not completely destroyed. So if you say all men are just, and then you find one who's not, the conclusion is not therefore, well, no men are just. Right?
Some men are just.
However.
So technically the phrase some men are just is a contradiction of all men are just.
Not necessarily. Because if all men are just, then some men are just too.
No, because saying some implies that some are not.
No, it's a particular. It's a particulars.
Well, hold on. So some men are just contradicts the claim that no men are just. It right. does not contradict that all men are just. So some men are not just contradicts all men are just. And then some men are just contradicts no men are just.
Okay, but technically some men are just and some men are not just is basically saying the same thing.
But it's not. This is why it's important, because you would think that, but it's not the same thing.
How?
Because
he literally says it in here that it's the same thing, or that they can coexist at least. And the exact words in our translation are that those phrases imply each other. It may be implies it may not be. That's what he says.
May is different than some.
Okay, true.
Because some is a statement about a particular population. May is a statement about potentiality of something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if we make the statement all balls are red, or let's make it real, all balls are round.
Okay.
Well, go get some balls, and you can say, okay, well, some balls are round.
Yeah, because there's footballs.
Damn it.
That's not round.
That's a bad example.
It's more like conical.
All water is wet.
Okay.
And don't give me this dehydrated water crap. All water is wet. Go get some water. That water's wet.
Okay.
That doesn't imply, just because some water is wet doesn't somehow mean that somewhere out there, some water is not wet. You have a small sample, but it's wet.
Oh,
it's
not okay. I get it now.
So it's not actually a contradiction.
Now I understand why it's important. Okay. I get it.
Hell yeah. This Aristotle guy really knows what's going on. But
all turtles are stupid. Martin is stupid.
Right. So that doesn't mean that somewhere out there is a smart turtle.
Okay.
Right?
I get it now.
So that's why it's important.
Thanks.
Isn't this fun?
It is fun. I hope we're not boring you guys.
No.
But yeah, now I get it.
This has become more and more just an area of interest for me, the importance of grammar. Because it could just be the fact that society has lost grammar, almost totally at this point. There's a a book that somebody recently made me aware of called Gwyn's Grammar. Gwyn has also written a book on Latin, and I got his book on Latin as well. But in this book in his book on grammar, he says that he makes the case. He takes a couple of chapters to try to drill this home that this could be the most important book in the world, because all grammar, all civilization depends on grammar. Everything that depends on grammar. And he even says in there, you can't argue that it doesn't, because to argue that you don't need grammar, you need grammar to make that argument.
Right.
It's a relatively recent book. I think he wrote it 2013, 2014. But he's just kind of sounding the alarm, like, hey, we're losing grammar and we can lose civilization because of it. So he says that there's nothing more important than that. And I'm like, I totally agree with him, you know, that they're really in the grand scheme of things, there's very few things more important than grammar.
Yeah,
right.
That's part of the reason I've been on a sort of tech kick lately, trying to work it all out metaphysically. And so because of that, I watched part of one of the old Elon Musk interviews on Joe Rogan. And one of the things that they talked about was how, you know, one day, and Musk is like, oh, it's going to happen in 10 years. We'll see about that. One day we're going to be able to put these chips in people's brains. And it's going to be that if I have a chip and you have a chip, we don't need to speak. We'll just be able to read each other's thoughts. And they just kind of mentioned that, like, oh, that's the future. Isn't that cool? And then move on. Like, my thoughts aren't ready for you to hear them. That's mm-hmm. the process of grammar.
That's the whole point.
I have a thought. Actually, one thought isn't really one thought. There's the pre-thought, you know, there's that little inkling. And then it's kind of articulated in your head, but then it's kind of forged a little bit. And it's weird because time almost dilates in your thoughts. Like, it forms, and then I let it come out.
Oh, it dilates. That's a funny word for it.
It goes through this process of development. It's almost like a gestation and birth that happens in a period of seconds. And by cutting off that process of actually having to materialize your words into sounds, your thoughts into sounds, that the importance of grammar, I think we're ignoring it because we're being tempted by this futuristic technology thing. But it, such a technology that allows us to just read each other's thoughts might very well be the thing that absolutely destroys our capacity for discovering true meaning. Because, I mean, talk about signal to noise ratio being completely blown out. If I just heard all of the thoughts in everyone's head, most of the thoughts in my head are gibberish because they're just free-floating synapses waiting to be formed into a pattern.
Half the things you say out loud are gibberish.
Right, right. So how it seems like we've completely, to your point, as a culture, we've just thrown grammar in the garbage, said, it's boring. Who needs that old classical crap?
A really interesting example of that, the Neuralink thing.
Yeah. Well, no one's thinking about it that way. Like, they completely blew over that part of the conversation that, hey, maybe carefully forging your words for presentation might, I don't know, be a fundamental part of human language. We'll just read each other's thoughts. That'll be fine.
Oh my gosh.
Well, there's more to it than that as well, because, like, you know, as Bob Podolsky points out, the six channels of communication, there's a channel within us, that our conscious versus our subconscious mind, and just essentially being able to connect those two together is a similar process where you've got to, like, agree on, you know, like the same things, the basic elements, then you can kind of, you know, establish a communication thing. It's the same with you know, the nonverbal language that goes between us too, because that functions in the role of, like, the subconscious, between people. The nonverbal signals are what, you know, relate a great deal of information that we're not even conscious of, but it does give us, you know, relevant information. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like, you know, like if you get a person, you know, it's rather unique because you get a person from one side of the planet and you put them in front of a person from the other side of the planet, and they're nonverbal signals are still the same.
Right.
Yeah, I've got this right here.
Oh, he actually knows where that one is.
The body reader, social aspects of the human body. And this is all about exactly that. How basically body people talk about social constructs and all this stuff. Sure, there are some, but there are also things that are absolutely universal. And body language is one of them.
The pee dance. You always know, yeah, you know the pee dance.
So that's essentially like another representation of grammar and basically mm-hmm. like a natural version of grammar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. There's remember that show Lie to Me?
I was just thinking about that.
You guys remember that? It's based mm-hmm. on a real dude, Paul Ekman. It was a show. No, Britton, you shook your head. It was briefly a show about this dude who could look at the micro expressions on your face, like not even overt body language, like this kind of stuff. But like a twitch of the eye, a twitch of the lip.
Your pupils dilating. All these like that.
Really minor things.
Like a drop, a bead of perspiration on your top lip.
He formulates a logic that, you know, and it's scientific. It's actually based in true science from the real world, where this guy went to like all these tribes and then studied people in the quote unquote civilized world and found that we all do these certain things with our faces that we don't register. It's not as overt as me crossing my arms and shaking my head. It's like I involuntarily raise my eyebrow whenever I do a certain thing. And right. that's across humanity.
What's even more, though, is, and this is what Agnieszka kind of the somatic kind of responses to your body, because if that reaction keeps happening, you know, like the crow's feet under my eyes here, mm-hmm. that essentially is like a long term, like that is something that you're dealing with every day. It's, you know, and so like reading those kind of features, you know, it also communicates a whole lot of information, but it's all on a subconscious level. You know, to some degree, we understand it.
Mm-hmm. Like somebody with a lot of lines here probably smiled a lot in their life.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. This is why I've been working on my poker face for years. Yeah. No lines.
It's like every now and then you run into an old man who just looks like.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
that. You're like, damn, that guy's been married to his wife for a long time.
Yeah, he's had a rough one, that guy. It's funny, you really can read people's lives if you know, obviously to an extent, but you really can read a lot in people. And
like my grand's most prominent line is right here.
Yeah. But so much of this grammar is occurring unconsciously without us really registering it. And we can't help but share that. We can't help but share our face. But the more conceptual stuff, you know, I can read maybe certain attitudes that you have in your face, but that doesn't tell me what you think about
yes.
the nature of reality.
Or that exactly why. I'm cutting you off, can I?
I couldn't stop you if I wanted to.
So I've been thinking about how many lines of communication there are within our beings, like between our organs and our cells and hormone cascades, and how many of those things we aren't aware of, and how many of them we're only vaguely aware of, and how many of them we actually express on the outside of our body, and how I wonder if understanding our language more clearly can help us be more mindful of all of those processes as well. And then the other thing I was going to say when I cut you off was that grammar, that physical grammar, that like micro expressions and things like that, we can see like vague things like consternation, anger, impatience, but we don't know why exactly. Like Danny reads my face all the time and he's like, "You're mad at me." And I'm like, "No, I'm trying to sew." And I just stabbed myself in the finger with a needle. You know, stuff like that. And so again, I think that having this underlying structure in your thought process that clarifies these rules can help not just with language, but with all other kinds of information processing. What do you guys think?
100%. I'm with you.
I hope it helps me anyway.
Well, I'm going to take the contrary position.
Okay.
That's never true. No, I think you're right. I think you're right. But the importance of Aristotle taking the trouble to articulate the formal elements of conceptual thought, which of course can also be used to describe material things, and often is and should be. But we can use his logic to also develop conceptual things. Like, for example, if someone makes a statement about all men being just, and then we find a sample of men not being just, then we know, because of that contradiction, that not all men are just. And so then it becomes sort of our quest to figure out, well, are there some who are? And it kind of, just by using his logic, we can understand and define the parameters of reality, which can then motivate us to go on our sort of individual quest, as in like, well, what is the good life? What is truth? What is beauty? What is goodness? We can be imbued with a sort of ethical mission in a way, if we want to take it that route.
Well, I think he's going to, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll get to that.
Right. But I'm saying, like, this lays the groundwork for, because people talk like this, oh, logic is cold and calculating and doesn't care. But if you actually read this stuff and you consider the implications of it, you find that not only can you not have ethics without logic, logic leads you to it almost automatically.
Oh.
Like the lot by doing this logic, we're going to wind up having to talk about ethics. So this whole like Dr. Spock caricature of logic that we've had is like robotic thinking. Well, I don't buy it.
It's not, human logic is not computer logic.
Right. And that leads to a whole larger question about technology, but we've been having that conversation all week.
I'd just like to throw in something because it was another discussion that I saw on YouTube in regard to this particular book. And he said that the second section was like, I think the key word that he used was like deliberation, and this idea of like basically sussing out the information, you know, whether it's so like you're confirming or denying what is true and what isn't. And, you know, like kind of getting to coming to a conclusion. Is that what you would describe from what you read?
What was the first thing you said? Something about a liberation?
Deliberation. Internal deliberation or an external deliberation. But that idea of like confirming, is this true or is this not true?
What I got out of it is it's in that vein. It's more in this book, we're not coming to conclusions yet. What we're doing is eliminating impossible conclusions. And that's like the articulation of these contraries and contradictions. He's saying we don't quite know what is true yet, but here's a way of eliminating what is definitely not true.
Okay.
So that was my interpretation of
on it. Yeah, obviously that's true.
That makes sense.
So does anyone have any final things to say about on interpretation before we lock it up?
Well, I'll just share a little preview of a speech that I'm going to be making tomorrow in regard to this, because and that was kind of that part about the deliberation kind of thing, is because I'm doing a speech on what I'm calling the four sons of Horus. And those represent, in this particular case, four jars that store four different organs that represent memory. But the idea is that it's, and this is from James True, by the way, that I got this idea, but it's this kind of the Egyptian idea of what memory is, and then how do you utilize it to kind of come to a conclusion, and how you kind of have that internal discussion with yourself. There's a lot to this, of course, but the four sons of Horus are also kind of the four elements, the four ancient elements, the fire, water, wind, and air, I think, right? Or no. Fire, water, wood, I think is one of them. But then there's four animals, or there's four creatures that represent different things. But it's this idea of like each of these things having a responsibility, and then those coming together in a period of time, and then you get to like digest that information. And there's just so much of this, but I've got a visual that I used to represent all this, and I thought I'd just share that with you. Okay, so these are the four. Can you see the four jars here?
Yes, sir.
So these are the four Egyptian gods. They represent the four directions. They also these are the body parts that are kind of installed in each. You know, of course, these are kings, right? Pharaohs. that this is all representing. But these are different, what he calls somatic antennas that are different lengths. Yeah. So like, you know, like the intestines are 22 feet long. The liver is 5.5 inches long. The lungs, actually, this is kind of like the analyst, you know, like this idea of the amount of air that we consume over a period of time and how far that ranges, and like sense and stuff like that. I don't know exactly how I came up with this number, but then, of course, the stomach is 12 inches. And then the like the gestation time for each of these is different. And then, of course, the animal that represents, and then these also represent these different things like digestion, emotion, and breathing. They're all different representations of kind of responsibilities that if you bring those things together in an event, like you experience something, and then you kind of digest that information. Each of these things represents these responsibilities in context with that particular thing. So it's like four perceptions of each of these things in all these different areas. And then, of course, it also, you know, is that kind of thing about space and time, bringing those things together. So like if you're talking about the quadrivium, you know, the arithmetic is number, geometry is number and space, music is number and time, and astronomy is number and time and space. And so this kind of represents all four of those things. But in any case, I'm going to try and make that make this case that this is you know, kind of another version of logic, and like logic over a period of time, you know, this idea of deliberation. To some degree, these are other senses that might relate us to reality that we don't even really recognize. That you know, like if we knew that it takes like 5 days for us to really make a good decision, because we have to like let our body kind of digest the information and to come to like a real conclusion, more than likely we wouldn't be buying shit, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, and like all this stuff with materialism wouldn't be happening.
That's a great point.
And so I think it's a great way to kind of think, but it's also a great kind of basis for kind of understanding that like the logic portion of who we are and how we go about is in relation to time. Uh-huh. And so like, you know, like us being, and of course they're, you know, like the experience that we're having, they're trying to shorten our attention span so that we make these, you know, we make these emotional decisions on a whim, and the opposite is something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a hell of a lot of basis that, you know, kind of this represents kind of the Egyptian ancient wisdom, but this relates directly to like what we just talked about with Aristotle.
Absolutely. Right. Pull the instinctual into the articulate so you can tell the difference between what makes sense and what feels nice in the moment.
Yeah, cool.
I like that. I wish you luck on your speech there, but I think you'll do
well, that visual you shared, I could not find that anywhere. I could not find anywhere where they put all that information together in one thing. So I made that myself.
Oh, nice.
Nice, looks good.
Yeah, the Egyptians also had just such a good aesthetic.
They did.
So nice.
They did. We're lucky in Cleveland here to have our art museum has a bunch of Egyptian artifacts in it. And it's just so cool to hang out in that room.
It's spooky, yeah, too. It's definitely spooky.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming. This was an exceptionally good meeting, I think. And we will do it again.
Okay. Wonderful.
Thank you guys so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
I can't believe we're like, so this is the end of week 50 or 52nd going around. So we've been doing this for over 2 years. Huh?
Yeah. October of 2018.
Wow. That is so cool.
This is when we started, I think. It's been a long time.
That's so cool.
And we're still on the Greeks. Yep. Yep. Number 52 we just did.
Cool.
All right, guys.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care, everyone. Until next time.
Bye.
Thank you.